How about now? Better? All right. I've never been accused of being too quiet. Thanks for the invite to talk. And I'm going to talk about the game, which as some of you saw, hopefully, who didn't see the game? I mean, who did not play the game? I assume most people did not actually get a chance to play the game. Who did not actually even see the game or even observe? Okay, so everybody kind of got at least a little bit. Okay. And it's a game about AI in a lot of ways. But I'm also going to, as is my way, do a little bit of ranting towards the second half. So, first off, what is Spy Party? Well, it's a video game, obviously, that I'm working on. And the kind of goal behind Spy Party at the highest level aesthetic goal, or kind of a kind of the super high concept elevator pitch that doesn't actually speak about what it actually is that I think that when you think about a spy movie, for example, like James Bond or something, he spends some time shooting stuff and driving cars fast, but the vast majority of the time it's James Bond being cool and you know seducing women and like you know sneaking into the place and all of these things that that we traditionally associate with spies. But the video game version tends to take the like he's ski jumping away from explosions part and expands that out to the entire game. They don't do any of the cool behavioral stuff. So I want to do a game that's basically less of this and more of this. Spies are an interesting spy and mystery fiction is a kind of interesting place to play because it's very behavioral, but the behaviors are very there are a lot of tropes and kind of rules and caricatures of human behavior as opposed to doing something like you know the Terms of Endearment game, which I have no idea how you'd actually make that game because we're not at that level yet, right? But with spies, you can kind of get away with anything, but you've still got this really interesting characterization going on. So it's a nice place to play for behavior if you're into and you all should be into human behavior as a topic. For game design. So I guess I won't bother doing a demo since most people saw it. I'll just talk over this screen. Basically, the high concept of the game imagine a 60s era, and this is all this art is placeholder, a 60s era Casino Royale-esque cocktail party with all the usual suspects from spy and mystery fiction, right? You know, there's the dude in the tuxedo, and there's the ingenue in the slip dress, and there's the kung fu guy, and there's the, like, you know, you can see the paparazzi guy, and the banker guy, and the, like, general from the Banana Republic, and et cetera. All the usual suspects, Miss Marple, the old dowager lady, the mad scientist in the wheelchair who alienates everybody. And they're all at a party doing party-like things, you know, having drinks and smoking and looking at the artwork and whatever, telling jokes. So there are going to be lots of different modes of the game, but the kind of most core pure mode is the one that was just play-tested here, which is one of the people in the party is controlled by the spy. And that person is doing all the normal stuff, pretending like they're at this cocktail party, doing these cocktail party-like things. But at the same time, they're trying to do spy missions, and they're kind of tropes from spy and mystery fiction, like bug the ambassador, or contact the double agent, or poison the drink of the general, or those kinds of things, right? And they're trying to do this without being discovered by the other player, who is outside the party, looking in, trying to determine which one is the player-controlled guy, and which one is, you know, and who's not the NPC, who's not the controlled by the computer. All of the other characters in the game you saw, it was 13. In this screenshot, I think it's 20, are controlled by the computer. So in that sense, it's an inverse Turing test, right? Like you've got a human trying to pretend like they're a computer rather than a computer trying to pretend like they're human, which in turn makes it a tractable problem and kind of a fun video game too. So that's cool. When you talk about games, I wish more people actually did this and more designers thought this way, but when you talk about games, you really want to talk about what your aesthetic goals, and I'll actually go into why I think this is important for this AI talk as well, but some of the aesthetic goals that I'm going for in Spy Party include things like perception versus deception and performance, right? These are humanistic level things. They're not, I want to be a giant space marine and teenage, you know, power fantasy. They're kind of everyday things that you deal with, obviously turned to 11 because it's spy silliness, but it provides a play field for these to kind of explore some of these topics. So perception and deception, attention as a resource, managing your attention, both the sniper and the spy have this problem. How much time do you spend looking here versus there? Making consequential decisions with partial information. You heard multiple people who are playing sniper saying, "Well, I just got to take a shot. I'm not sure who it is, but I don't want to let the time run out." Or some people are like, "I don't want to. You know, I'm not sure. I don't have enough information." Related to all this is deduction versus intuition. You know, a game like Clue is a completely deductive game. Like you can grind out Clue, and it was Mr. You know, it was Colonel Mustard in the study with the candlestick. I want some deductive stuff. So, for example, one of the missions that you may have seen was the contact and the double agent mission. The contact and the double agent mission, you're in a conversation with a bunch of people. You say the secret code word, which the spy and the sniper both hear. And only someone talking, meaning doing like, you know, talking kind of animation, can be it at that time. So that drastically narrows the space down, but it doesn't completely narrow it down. And there aren't enough of those deductive style missions to actually narrow it totally down. So you have to use your intuition sometimes. The best games, which happen, luckily, knock on wood, pretty frequently, are where the sniper is like, yeah, that they shoot someone, and I'll say, well, why did you shoot that person? And they'll say something like, well, they were acting like with too much intentionality. Like they looked like they had a purpose, whereas the rest of the people at the party are kind of just all hanging out and doing things, right? And so I'm going to actually give the AI's purpose too, like cross purposes, like the general chase skirts throughout the whole party, right? And so like you're going to have to like filter out, once I get even more behavioral stuff in there, filter out that kind of purpose from, oh wait, he's going from the bookshelf to the statues. That's really weird. Sometimes NPCs get shot when they just randomly decided to go from one bookshelf to the other, right? So being able to like, can we kind of make those decisions and kind of weigh that? And that gets to this thing of analysis paralysis versus what they call the opposite of extinct by instinct, where basically how fast do you go with your gut, right? Like you don't want to like sit there and not ever make a decision, but at the same time, you can't just make a snap judgment. In fact, there are kind of two play styles at the far ends of sniper play. And they're kind of, I call them the sociopaths and the empaths. So Will writes an example of the sociopath where he'll just shoot first and then like want to play again. Like, oh, let's play again. Wrong. Oh, let's play again. Like, it doesn't matter to him. Whereas Heim Gingold, who a bunch of you know, won't shoot anybody until he's absolutely sure. It's like, I don't want to kill the little people. So like, there's like, two opposite ends. And I think playing in a space between that is really interesting. And then finally, the game is extremely asymmetric, which is really interesting to me. From a design standpoint, because there aren't actually that many games, if you think about it, that are extremely asymmetric. There are moments in some games, like a penalty kick in soccer and that sort of thing, that are extremely asymmetric. But even a game that is kind of lauded for its asymmetry, like say StarCraft, starts from this common base. And then you know how different the Protoss and the Zerg and the humans feel depends on how deep you get into that game. But they're all pretty much. If you showed my mom that game, she wouldn't think it was very asymmetric, right? Whereas this game has complete asymmetry, which makes it very hard to tune, right? Because you want to. It's difficult to tune two completely different games happening in the same space. But that also makes it very interesting. If you contrast Spy Party with a game like Assassin, which is the college campus game, which is has a couple digital versions now. There's a game called The Ship that was on Steam a little while ago, a few years ago, and Assassin's Creed Brotherhood multiplayer that just came out. Those are actually symmetric games in the sense that this is a college campus game. Is you have a hat full of names, and you draw. You know, you're playing with these people. You draw a name out of the hat. That's your target. Somebody else drew your name. If you kill that person, you get their target. Yada yada yada. You play this. I mean, lots of people play this. And it's a fun game. But you're not only looking for your target all the time. But you're always trying to watch your back too, right? So this is symmetry. It's locally asymmetric for you, but this is symmetry in the overall game, and it means that you can't ever focus on one of those tasks at a time, right? So. Whereas in Spy Party, the sniper is never going to get shot from behind. All they need to do is relax into trying to filter through the stream of information coming at them. And the spy never has to worry about hunting someone down. They just need to worry about managing how much, you know, their performance. And that allows, I think, you to get to a pretty pure level of those two things. And I find that really interesting. So there's kind of a lot of ramifications of the asymmetry. So mechanically speaking, I basically am trying to completely focus right now on player skill. The reason there was a 4-page instruction manual for a game, which is basically like a no-no these days, right? Every game nowadays is supposed to be incredibly accessible and very easy to get into, is that I'm following the Blizzard depth-first, accessibility-later development model, where you go completely for the core gameplay first, as hardcore as you can make it. Basically, as Rob Pardo says, the game that people want to play for 3 years, right? Then you can always make it accessible later. I can Go is a really huge influence on me from as a designer, and Go is just amazing from the standpoint of the handicapping. Like, I can play a very advanced player. I suck at Go, but I can play someone who's really good, and Go's handicapping system is so well designed that we can both have entertaining games, and that's kind of the Holy Grail. And so I'm going to try and do some of that stuff to make it more accessible in single player tutorials and stuff like that. But right now I'm trying to hit that basic esports level of player skill. This is the Korean characters for Gosu, which not only means coriander, but also means like extreme expert level player. In most games, the player skills, like Counter-Strike is one of my favorite games. In most games, the player skills that you're cultivating in your players look like this. You know, map navigation, aiming and shooting, micro if you're into RTS kind of games, combat strategy, both, you know, FPS style combat strategy or RTS macro. And this is not what I'm interested in doing. These are awesome. I love games like this. But the player skills that I want to turn to 11 are these. Basically, these human level skills. The fantasy that I had that actually, like at IndieCade, I'll tell a little story from IndieCade, but the fantasy that I have is that you'll have someone who's awesome at, and I've been saying this for months, like this is kind of like my goal in terms of like a playtest session where you'll have someone who's awesome at FPSs, who's a totally badass, like really experienced shooter player, and they'll sit down with someone who's much more intuitive, a good people person, and the FPS guy will have his ass handed to him. Because the game is not about shooting skills. I mean, yeah, there's some base level, like how do I steer the camera, but once you're past that, the first 5 minutes of that, then it's much more about just watching. And so we were at IndieCade this weekend, and which is a kind of independent game developer festival thing down in LA, and a bunch of friends were sitting around, and some of the friends that were sitting around were John Romero, who is the guy, who, you know, one of the designers on Doom, you know, and Quake in those games, and Brenda Braithwaite, who's a good game player, but is not like John Romero. And Romero plays her a lot, and is constantly destroying her utterly. And they sat down at a spy party, and she killed him like 10 times in a row. Like he would like start moving, and he'd get shot. And she was just cackling with glee because it was this experience she had never been able to have before with him, because he's so good at gamey games that emphasize what side is that? Left-hand side, player skills. But this game actually tries to emphasize the right-hand side player skills, and so I think that's really interesting. It is a gamer game. It is not trying to be accessible. It's not trying to make a social game or, you know, a game that's accessible to my mom. It is a game, you know, if my mom wants to play it, she's going to have to practice it and get good. But I want her to be on a level playing field or a better, you know, above someone who has no social skills and is just good at Twitch mechanics, right? So this is the, and so that was kind of interesting, a slight validation. I mean, it's way too early. I've got years left on this game, so I'm not trying to say that it's there by any stretch of the imagination. It's very early, but it's great that it's kind of starting to work out that way. Knock on whatever this is made of. However, these mechanics that and these kind of goals have these ramifications. If, like, for example, if we want performing NPC behavior to be a player skill, that implies certain things about the architecture underneath. For example, it implies that the spy and the NPC should share the same behavior systems. The way the internet works with like walkthroughs and forums discussing games, especially if you're going for that like Counter-Strike level player skill. I mean, my game, the kind of jokey way I, you know, in games, the kind of creatively bankrupt way of describing your game is X meets Y. And so the way I describe Spy Party is Counter-Strike meets The Sims, which basically means absolutely nothing when you think about it, but it kind of gets to where I'm trying to play in that. But so these, when you try and do a game like Counter-Strike or a game that has an intense level of player skill, they'll talk about every aspect of your game on the forums, and they'll dissect everything. So if there are differences in the way the spy and the NPCs behave that are not caused by the player, then it's going to get out immediately, and then you don't have an esports level player skill game anymore, because you can just look for that. So I think it was you that came up and asked, will the NPCs ever do X? That I saw something happen, it looked like it was a tell from the spy stick for the spy. And I said, no, to my knowledge, and I need, and I'll give another example of this later. To my knowledge, the NPCs and the spy will do the same thing, not the same frequency. I mean, if you ran a, you know, Markov model on it and like looked at the histogram, it's gonna be completely different, I think. But the space of affordances for the both is the same. And that's really important. The second thing is, I think it forces you into certain types of technical solutions to certain types of problems. Meaning, in normal game development, you come across something that you need to solve, and you can go one of n different ways. And I think that having this player being able to perform as an NPC biases you towards some sorts of solutions, and I'll talk about that in a second. So here's an example of some of the low-level stuff. So there's a really crappy Pathfinder in my game right now. It's a grid-based A-star Pathfinder. But the thing about it is that the SPI controls, when you're using the Xbox controller, feed into the Pathfinder at the same level that the NPC pathing happens, right? And that's incredibly important because it means that a skilled spy can move exactly like the NPC, because they're actually, instead of it being, you know, the normal way you do a game with the Xbox controller or whatever, or mouse or whatever, is, you know, you map the 360 degrees of this onto the ground and you get the guy drive that way. Mine actually feeds that into the pathing system and tries to do a short, incrementally updated path to that point, you know, a few feet out in front of him, basically, which means that all the local avoidance and everything comes out of the Pathfinder, not the player. I mean, the player can help and bias it to go, you know, around to the left or around to the right in a way that you can't really tell from looking. But it has to feed in at that level, or else you're going to find, like, oh, well, I know that, I mean, this Pathfinder really is really crappy, like an 8 cardinal directions kind of thing, right? And so you'd be able to notice, a skilled sniper would be able to notice, you know, someone who wasn't moving at, you know, 135 degrees, right? Because it just looks a little different, you know? So that's really important. And this actually, someone asked about that kind of, why is it on the controller? The mouse right now, and I'm about to take this out, is click to move. When you do a sim-style game, the first thing you do is click there, and you run that through the Pathfinder, and dude walks over there, right? And so when I was going to do it on the, when I started to move it over to the console controller, I want to support both so that I can keep my options open from a, you know, from a shipping standpoint later on. There comes this question of, the reason the Sims games all suck on the consoles is because you can't do click to move on the controller very well. Actually, like, how do you actually move the, like, cursor over there and select where you want it to go? It's just a pain in the butt. So I was like, but I didn't want to do analog control because I had this idea that I wanted the game to be about behavior, not about movement, right? And that seems too low level. And then I kind of had this insight, or I had this realization that if you think about playing a shooter, for example, a mouse look style 3D, you know, Halo or Quake or whatever, you don't actually think about moving very much in those games. You know, the control system actually sublimates. You think about what you want to do and how to express it, but you don't think about, I'm now going to strafe with this key and do this. It just becomes part of your fingers after a few, you know, an hour's worth of play. You're just totally facile with it, right? But it actually, not only does it go away, but it also adds depth. That ability to express yourself in that analog space actually adds a significant component of depth to those games. They feel better than they would if they were click to move. And you feel more in touch with your character in the world, and there's an added skill component to that. When I actually just realized that you're not going to actually worry about the movement, it's just going to sublimate, and I put it in there, it got even deeper. And so, like, my goal is I'm constantly looking for features that make it a deeper and deeper game so that I can, like I said, get to that incredible level of player skill before I ease up and do the accessibility thing. And that analog control, although it's frustrating for new players, once you've played it, actually gives you this, like, the ability to move your camera and move the thing and, like, choose where you're going to go and push in. And it actually uncovers some really interesting depth-based gameplay. Like, for example, this concept of moving with confidence. One of the things that I think is working best with the game right now, there's a ton of stuff broken about the game, but one of the things that I think it is actually hitting one of the interesting aesthetic goals is this idea of, you have to play it cool when you move imprecisely. Like, you move somewhere and you're not exactly where you want to be. In a normal game, you would just adjust. In this game, that'll get you shot if the sniper's paying attention. So you kind of have to, like, breathe through it. You're like, I'm not exactly where I wanted to be, but this is good enough, or it's not. And even if it's not good enough, then I need to wait here for a second, not look like I'm panicking, and then walk away. And that starts to play at this level that I want to get to, where you're actually thinking, like, I mean, it reminds me of the kind of, I was saying to someone earlier, like, in like a Hitchcockian type of, like, movie, you'd imagine, like, you know, the guy leaves the wine, you know, the martini glass with the lipstick on the mantle, and his wife comes home, and he's, like, freaking out that she's going to notice it, but he can't go get it, right? Because that would totally draw attention. And, like, Hitchcock would shoot that with the wine glass always in view. Like, wherever they were in the room, it would be, like, over in the corner or whatever. And it's, like, that kind of concept of, like, just breathe, everything's going to be okay. Most people don't notice everything in the world all the time, right? You just, like, kind of go with it. So this gets to that, and this I'm going to come back to that obviously is related to the control system and how the AI is architected, but it's also related to the game design, and that's a theme that comes up a lot. Another one is inverse kinematics. So you look at her on the ground there. There's a little pad in front of the statues, and the AIs will aim for that pad, and so will the player. The NPCs obviously could hit the center of that pad every time, right? But because I'm analog control, the player is not going to hit that every time. Even if it was click to move, unless I auto-centered the thing when you clicked on the pad, the entire thing. So the traditional way to line up animations to pick something up is you just make sure everybody's docked correctly in the correct, you know, they're registered correctly in the thing. But I can't do that if I want to actually have this analog level of control, because the spy's not going to line. So what I need to do is actually break the NPCs as opposed to fix the spy, right? So I need to make sure the NPCs actually will randomly randomly target any place in that pad to stop. As opposed to auto-docking, to get that, you want to make the game constantly work with what the player is doing. So there's this constant interplay of making sure the player can do what the NPCs can do, but also making sure the NPCs are likely to do what a player would do. And so this give and take. And so, for example, I think probably before, as I get deeper and deeper, right now it's a completely flat, uniform distribution of where you'll land in that. And I bet it's like some Poisson thing. Gaussian in the middle, or I'm not sure, but I'm going to have to journal and get some metrics to measure that and make sure that they're similar, because like I said, these hardcore guys will actually figure that out. And I want to make it so that there aren't tells like that that are not things that the spy screwed up on or while they're accomplishing missions. Similarly with the conversation circles, that's like, it doesn't pull you into the circle. You have to actually keep walking into the circle and then stop where you want to stop. And so there are slight differences. And so, of course, their AIs randomize where they are. And the AIs actually adjust a very small percentage of the time just to throw off snipers who are just looking for that kind of level of tell. And it was frustrating because I was at E3 this year, and I was working on the system to have people pick things up, like the full body IK system, and like you got to have objects and blah, blah, blah. It's just a pain. Making games is a pain in the butt, right? And I was walking around the show floor, and like, then I could not find a single other game besides The Sims where characters even pick things up. Like, I mean, occasionally you'll come across a game where like dude will pick up a car and throw it or whatever, but there's no high fidelity. Like, I'm holding a cigarette, I'm picking up a thing, just any kind of like, you know, just human scale interaction with objects is just incredibly rare. Heavy Rain does a tiny bit of it, but it's not very interactive. The Sims obviously does it, but you look at The Sims and like they concentrate more on breath as opposed to depth. Like, you know, each individual animation is not that great or anything like that. They just have a ton of stuff going on in there. No one's trying, and mine looks crappy too. Now it's really hard. Oh, nice speaker, cell phone. That was genius. But no one works on this stuff. No one does games at this human scale level, and that's just a bummer. Like, every game on the show floor is like, there's the giant gun, and you run over it, and it disappears, and it's in your inventory, you know? And that's a shame. I just wish more people worked on this human scale stuff, because, like, there's just a lot of interesting design and technical problems in there that we need to solve. I mean, you watch a TV show like Friends or something, and, like, people are walking around doing stuff. They pick up an apple, they eat it, they, like, write in a notebook, they pick up, like, remote control for the TV, they, like, you know, hug each other, they do all of this stuff that, like, games just, we don't even have, like, even ignoring how to make a game that design-wise, we don't even have like the technical basis for how to do that stuff. Like, even getting two characters to like shake hands is difficult, right? And so it's just kind of a bummer. You feel kind of alone working on human scale, like normal people stuff in the industry. I was trying to figure out what the I came up with this name situations. Like, what is the set of overlapping things that you find yourself in at a party? And the best name I could come up with was situations. So you look at this guy, they're simultaneous and layered. You look at the guy in the background. He's got a cigarette in one hand, a drink in the other hand. He's reacting to Peter Sellers being an ass in the foreground. There's a lot of stuff going on. Everyone else is looking at him because he was talking a second ago, but then he caught out of the corner of his eye that Peter Sellers was doing this thing. And like, the AI system to implement this is like kind of complicated. Like, I mean, you want to be able to layer stuff on, so you don't want to drown in the complexity, but it's not just one thing. It's not like, I make a plan to go do this thing. There's like multiple simultaneous things going on here. So I'm trying to figure out a way of doing this, and I've come up with something that's kind of crappy right now, but I hope to like go deeper on this. So here's an example. So a spy might find himself in a situation as a context-dependent, interaction of picking up a book, and I want the So the NPCs just see the, like, pick up the book, put back the book, those affordances, and they have some percentage chance that they'll do them in, you know, normal probability stuff. The spy needs to be able to spy missions piggyback on top of the normal NPC situation, and now, okay, you've picked up a book, is it the book with the microphone in it? Okay, let's add this affordance on as the spy affordance and that kind of thing. So I need this layered kind of, like, inherit is a pretty loaded word nowadays with object-oriented blah, 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 but I more mean piggybacked. But you need to be able to have them talk to each other when it's appropriate, obviously, and at a pretty deep, high touch level. And so, when the spy's in a given situation, in my game, they track the state as if they were an NPC. And this is pretty weird, because in most games, you don't, like, if the person's hiding behind cover, you know they're crouched or whatever. You don't actually know what they're doing most of the time, right? The player's not, you don't track the state. Like, you don't know what the player's doing if they were an NPC. Whereas in Spy Party, you actually need to do this. And this is another example of a bug that I didn't even know was a bug until I started to, like, refactor the AI system. So there's a banana bread thing. So you can, you're in the conversation circle with the double agent, and you want to say the code word banana bread. And the obvious thing to do is make sure you do it when there's a lot of other people talking, both around the room and in your conversation circle. And this is the advice I would give people, and what I thought to, when I did myself, I would play this way. And then I looked at the code later, after lots of playtests. I mean, a lot of playtests. And I realized that because it wasn't tracking the state correctly, the only time two characters would ever be talking in a conversation circle at the same time was when one of them was a spy. Now, there's so much information flowing to the sniper that no one, even the elite players who had played 5 or 10 hours at this point, ever noticed this. But I realized I needed to fix that, because that's the kind of thing that will just kill you immediately once the game's actually released. So now there's an interruption model, and the spy gets interrupted just like everybody else. And when you interrupt, there's a certain percentage chance that the person will keep trying to talk over you for a little while, or maybe they'll leave in a huff and that kind of thing. But it needs to track the spy in that exact. Now, the spy won't actually leave the conversation. Obviously, the spy can just turn around and leave any time. That's under player control. But the spy will stop talking if they're interrupted, or will give the affordance to stop talking will show up when you get interrupted. And it knows the difference. You see, it knows when the person with the yellow triangle is speaking. It changes start talking into interrupt speaker as the affordance. So it knows the state of everybody, including you, and the conversation system doesn't even really know you're a spy. Not in any kind of, like, data hiding encapsulation. Just keep the code linear. Or clean. Not clean, but what's the right word? Like, just to make sure that there aren't bugs of, the spy gets special case when it's not totally necessary. So anyway, so here's the one slide I have basically on my AI system, which I don't actually think is very interesting. Maybe it will be eventually. They're basically sort of like Sims interactions, like the Sims interaction system, which has been published about a ton, except for Sims interactions can't run multiple at the same time. Anytime they're, like, holding something, that's done with kind of special cases. So in mine, it would be holding a drink would be running at the same time that talking would be, and it would own resource-based wise. And I actually think that, like, a lot of people do this resource-based allocation of the body for doing blending between different things, and I think it's a crappy way to do this. I don't know what the solution is, and it's what I do right now, but it does not feel right. I don't think of this as owning my arm while I'm doing this other thing. I'm not sure what the cognitive model is that would actually manage that well, but it doesn't feel like it's this, like, okay, now I own the arm, and so this animation and its set own the arm, and I bone mask out the rest and all this normal stuff that we do in games, that people do when they're actually trying to do something at this scale. And by this scale, I mean small, not like saving the planet from the aliens. It's easy code. There's one situation per file. It gets ticked in a bunch of different ways. It bottoms out at a C level switch statement. There's usually holding a drink probably has, I don't know, 7 states. There's usually probably between 2 and 10 states. I don't think there's any even with 10 in there. The spy dumps through the exact same code. It's just there's if statements, if this is the spy ticking through this code versus not, when to keep, things that might be a probability that then launches the affordance on the NPC side is just, okay, give the person the option to do that on the spy side. But I'm a pretty big fan of the C switch statement for small state machines. It's very hard to find a model for logic that happens across frames that is as easy to debug and understand as a C-level switch statement. And so even the behavior tree stuff that I did on Spore, which I think I tend to think of the behavior tree stuff Behavior trees, the goal of behavior trees in my mind was to put off needing to go to planning for a given level of complexity. So it managed, it allowed you to 10x your finite state machine complexity because of the way it did the tick from the top and the cancel out, you know, lower priority things and things like that, which I'm not going to go into, obviously, because that's all published stuff. But at the bottom level of every one of those behaviors was a C-level state machine for what's going on right there. And I think that's the right level of complexity, or the right level of like transparency of what's going on actually at the machine level, and like you can see what's going on. The concept of more opaque AI systems terrifies me, and for reasons that I'll go into in a little bit. And then it talks to a lower level animation system, obviously, to play animations and check state and get events and all that kind of stuff. And so I want to talk about, like, so that was it. Like, I'm not going to even go, I mean, I'll answer questions if people care, but there's no rocket science going on there. But it does, working on this and thinking about this has shown me that I think there are two open problems, and I don't mean open problems like, you know, P equals NP, kind of. Like, these are totally solvable problems that people just need to actually figure out the right thing. And I call them the outro problem and the AI anim problem. I may be the only people, I constantly meet programmers who think they've actually solved these problems. So I may be the only person who thinks that these are unsolved problems. I've never seen a solution to these problems that I think would call a solution, but a lot of people are selling slash in both all senses of the term selling solutions to these problems. So let's go into what they are. So the outro problem is, who's responsible for the outro of a behavior, right? So you want to change behaviors, you want to switch from this behavior to this other behavior. Who's responsible for shutting the currently running behavior down, right? Intros, by contrast, are totally trivial, I mean, for the most part. So I'm switching to this box behavior, right? And inside this box can be an intro that then dumps into the body that loops most of the time, and the person from the outside doesn't care, right? It's like the intro is just part of the, like, you know, behavior as far as they're concerned. It's not a big deal. By contrast, outros are a disaster. So I'm in the body, right? And stimuli comes in that makes me want to switch out of this behavior. So what do I do? Well, the dumb, like, okay, I'm a modular, I've got my finite state machine library and blah, 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 as I put an outro state on there. But what the hell runs in this finite state machine? Because it's got to shut itself down, and it's shutting itself down over time. The stimuli is still active. You're hoping the stimuli is still active. It could have been transient, in which case you might have even forgotten that it even happened. You're still in code, and you're supposed to be somewhere else. So this is a disaster. This is also a disaster. Who are you going to switch to? You can't just bail because they don't know who you were unless you've got this N squared, everyone knows about everything else. So it's just not clear at all what to do here. And most systems solve this problem by punting. The Spore AI system, the behavior tree system, and this is how Halo works as well, one of the ways it decoupled and solved the N squared behaviors need to know about other behaviors and stimuli problem is it just killed with extreme prejudice any lower priority behaviors that were going. So you check from the top, you decide like you're getting shot at. Well, if you were eating lunch, like boom, you just trust whoever's going to clean up in one frame. Like you don't deal with outros. Or you hope your animation state machine or the blender will fix it. You just like, okay, I'm gonna blend back to the rest pose, or I'm gonna like really hope somebody can find a set of states that get me from there to there. But these animation state machine oriented solutions where they're like, oh well, of course, if I'm sitting down, then my animation state machine should be really smart and know how to get me to stand up. And if it's got, you know, arms on the chair, then I'll play the animation that pushes it and it'll piece this together. And like 4 seconds later, the dude actually stands up. So you're just basically giving up any latency control if you do it that way too. So it's just not clear. And is the stimuli even there anymore? So do you even know where you're switching to? You're having to track all this stuff. It's not clear that any of the current solutions to me, and I've certainly never seen a game that I would call high quality, will result in high quality behavior and movement for this kind of switching state stuff. One solution to the outro problem is this animation state machine, so you push it down. So then you're just pushing the problem somewhere else, which is this AI NM problem. Which is how and what do the AI and the animation systems communicate? A lot of people, I mean, it's really de rigueur to try and decouple your code, right? You want to encapsulate and decouple and ever since the late 90s with object-oriented programming, like it's been really cool to like not have anyone know who's calling who and whatever. The problem is AI and animation are really intensely coupled problems, and decoupling those tends to lead to jerky behavior and pops and no latency control and all of these things that are the enemy of actually acting. I mean, watch a video of someone doing something. It's just not, it doesn't work like that. It's clear, and this is why I don't like the resource allocation thing. as a way of managing who's got what part of the body. It's just too encapsulated. I don't know the answer, but the problem with AI and animation systems is they're very similar, but not remotely identical states, right? So, you know, you might have a sitting in the chair animation and a sitting, I'm sitting down animation, AI state, and you might have a standing and a standing state, but the number of states you're gonna have in the AI system and the number of states you're gonna have in the animation system are not necessarily the same in between the sitting down and getting up, and you don't want them to be. So you don't wanna push the AI states down, and you don't wanna push the animation states up, and so what do? They have to communicate at a very, like I say, wide and bi-directional interface. There's events flying back and forth from both sides. You wanna be able to cancel animations, but not have it, you know, you wanna be able to control blending. There's a lot of floating point numbers going back and forth and discrete stuff like events, like when you pick something up, you have a whole bunch of information about where you're picking it up from. Your IKA system is constantly updating down there from targets that are happening at the cognitive level. And then an event fires when you're supposed to attach the object, right? And you attach the object, and now you've got this thing attached to your hand, and like all that's information going both directions, right? The combinatorics are deadly. Like, are you going to, like, if there's, you know, if it's one of those love seats that doesn't have an arm on one side, are you playing a different animation? How much of that stuff are you mirroring? But proceduralism there's no quality in proceduralism. Like, if you go too far down the proceduralism path to try and deal with the combinatorics problem, you give up a ton of quality, as you can see in any of these videos and demos of all of these, you know, procedural animation things. With Spore, we dodge the problem by just not having any reality. I mean, it's like, it's an eight-legged, four-headed creature, like whatever. You know, there's no expectations. But when you're doing humans, there's a ton of expectations. I'm gonna do as little proceduralism as possible. I have to have an IK solver, obviously, a full body IK solver, like I said in the previous slide, but I'm gonna try to have hand animated stuff wherever possible, because that's where you get the character out of of your art assets. So I don't know the solution to this problem either. I think, I'm pretty sure it doesn't look like this, though. There's a lot of people, this happens to be a screenshot of Havoc behavior, but it could have been EA's Ant system or any of these systems, which try and push all the smarts down into the AI, into the animation system. And unfortunately, what you end up with, in my experience, is you end up hiring another person to write state machines in the AI, or in the animation state machine manager now. And so now you've got an AI guy and the animation AI guy and the animator. And so now you've got, and maybe there's a technical artist in there somewhere too. And so, so you've got this huge mirroring of states. I mean, some of these systems go so insane as to actually allow one of the input pins you can have in some of these systems is controller, like the joystick axis. Like, you do not want that happening directly at your AI, at your animation system. You don't even really necessarily want it happening at your AI system. So I think these make it worse, not better. They make for really pretty, like, screenshots and quick demos, but once you're actually doing the game, my opinion on this, unless your actual AI to controller coupling is just so trivial and you're not really trying to do anything really difficult, I just don't buy this. So it may be prejudice, but there you go. And I actually think that both of these problems have the same root cause, which is this, that interesting things happen over time, behaviorally speaking, and computers suck at dealing with things that happen over time. Both computers themselves, computer languages, our programming environments, our mental models for how to do this. This is one of the reasons parallelism is so hard. We're just not good at dealing with things that happen across multiple frames. It sucks. You want to be in one state or another state, and when you're not, or when you're trying to blend, or when you're in six states at once, like, it's a pain. It's hard to debug. It's hard to even figure out what the right... You can't even write down the math to figure out what should happen part of the time, because it's so nonlinear and like the space is full of holes and stuff. You're just not even sure what the right thing to do. So I actually think these are both kind of similar, that this thing's happening over time. There's got to be a better method for dealing. And no, I don't mean somebody should go make a new language, computer language, because that's what people always tend to do, is like, oh, I'll make a computer language that deals with it. I don't know, but I think it's more along the lines of a way of dealing with that. Like, the way finite state machines work with switch statements and enums, like really simple state machines, have a lot of advantages and a lot of disadvantages, but you can see what's going on. And dealing with things over time, all of the current ways people tend to try and do this, oh, well, we should just do continuations because then we can, you know, yield, and then we can just have a straight linear code. That doesn't work either. I don't know. So I think this is the core of the thing. I don't have the answers. Sorry. Okay, so we're going to switch gears a little bit here and go a little more philosophical. How much time do I have left? And this is the part where I offend everyone in the room. Ready? Okay, so These were two things pulled out of two of the slides that were about the relatively low level. I mean, I wasn't showing code or anything, but a low level decisions about AI programming in BigQuery. So click to move versus analog control, we already talked about both of this, and whether you auto dock when you come up to a conversation circle. It would solve a lot of problems, don't need IK, blah, 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 but you know, whatever. Okay, so what is actually the commonality between these questions? Well, they're actually game design questions. They're not technical questions. I mean, they are technical questions, but they're clearly in the realm of game design. And I think that all AI programming is game design. And this is a problem. And this is a good thing, but it's a problem. I think that the lack of recognition of this fact and the failure to embrace it on the AI research community explains why they have had almost no impact on the community, on the game industry at large. Now, one quick thing you could say is, fuck you, game developers hate researchers. That's actually not true. The graphics community, for all of their flaws, has had a massive impact on the game industry and the networking industry, algorithms in general, in which I would categorize pathfinding and those kind of graph traversal things, I think are more that than they are the higher level stuff, although there's obviously a mix of things. Signal processing, massive impact. There's a ton of research communities that the game industry steals stuff from constantly. But the AI industry the AI research industry has had very little impact, I think, on moving things forward. And I think it's because of this, they have not embraced the kind of special place that they have in the game. So this is some code out of the middle of Spy Party, and I'm not saying I'm proud of this code. Like, it's just some crappy AI code in the middle of a game, right? This is what it looks like. And you look at here, and you're like, okay, wait, do I have a mouse cursor or not? You look here and you're like, oh, what the hell is this 0.0005 doing here? This is game design, right? Whether this is a less than or a less than equals sign is game design. Like, the rubber hits the road here. Game design documents are not game design. It's whether or not this is a less than or less than or equals sign. What the hell is this 0.2 doing here? Well, it was probably a 0.3 at one point, and like now it's a 0.2. And this, maybe it should be a named constant. I'll give you that. But this is game design. And you might think this should be in a file somewhere that's tunable and yada yada, and that may be true. I mean, Haim and I, in a prototyping talk a few years ago, gave what we call the Tower of Tuning. But at the bottom of the Tower of Tuning, and it's the most leverage, especially for small teams, is a constant in the code, right? Like, Spy Party recompiles in 5 seconds. Why would I bother pulling this out into some other XML-based blah, blah, blah that I have to maintain when I can just go change this number and recompile the game, right? This is just a tuning variable, but it is how the game feels. Every one of these things in here is what makes the game feel a certain way, and that's true of any game that's paying a lot of attention to how it feels, and that's all games that are really good. That kind of game feel, that tactility, that thing that makes it so you don't notice it, is all in whether these things are less than or less than or equals, or whether that's 0.0004 or 0.0005. Okay? Here was the best talk at the GDC in the game design track last year. Design in detail, changing the time between shots for the sniper rifle from 0.5 to 0.7 seconds for Halo 3. It's at Jamie Griesmer, and it was out of control, by far the best game design talk. It was amazing. I mean, it ranged far and wide, but it was all about this decision and the ramifications of that decision, which is one of these things, right? It was a variable somewhere. They probably had it in a file, but in a text file. But it was one of those things, and that change was you. I mean, he ran out of time. He had like 300 slides and got through 150 of them, which is bad talk management. But they were all interesting because there's so much in small decisions like that. So Frank Lance at IndieCade, he gave the closing keynote of IndieCade, was talking about interactivity and interactive systems, and he was saying interactivity is this kind of is the steam of the 21st century, the way steam was the steam of the 19th century, right? Like, it's the fundamental like thing, and he doesn't just mean games. I mean interactive systems, like computers that process your input. You know, you give them input, they process your input, and they spit back output, right? And then the loop continues. And he's saying interactivity shapes the way we think about things and all the stuff that we've all been talking about. And he said that, he kind of boiled it down, games are the aesthetics of interactive systems. So games are the aesthetic form attached to this concept of interactivity, right? And we all kind of believe this, hopefully. And some of us talk about how games are going to be the preeminent art and entertainment form of the 21st century, and he was saying why he believed that, and he believes it because of this. Games are the aesthetics of interactive systems. But as he was quick to point out at the very beginning, is that aesthetics is the opposite of science. Like, there, aesthetics is the stuff that is not science, right? It's about taste and beauty and all of these things. Now, there is beauty in math. I'm a huge fan. But that's not the same thing as saying that math is about beauty. Aesthetics is the non-science stuff. And so now I'm going to logically prove the following. AI is game design. Game design is the design of games, which are aesthetics, which are not science. So you are all hosed. And by you, I mean anyone who tries to do work in game AI without doing the game design part, the aesthetics part, right? And by doing the game design part, I mean making compelling games. I don't mean making a demo that you and your grad students or you and some small people play. I mean make a game that people want to play, and that is the test of your AI system. Doing AI without making games is like writing graphics code and never rendering it. So these are the computer sees these two as exactly the same. This is the first, I don't know what, 130 is, but 280 bytes of this image file. But they're not the same. So that's kind of what I'm trying to say. So this guy, John Carmack, what does that mean? So you got to make games? Games are hard to make. Oh man, what am I going to do, 3D models? Like, oh, this is a giant pain in the ass. So you have to pick your problems. I think the preeminent genius of John Carmack is that he was a perfect expert. He had this incredible intuition about writing the exact right size check that he could cash. Just big enough that it just stretched where he was going, but not so big that he couldn't, that it would bounce, right? So write checks you can cash, but you want to write them the biggest check you possibly can. He hit just over and over again during the time when he wasn't working on rockets, the exact right technology and game design for the time, for what computers could do, for what people were ready for. And I think it has kind of been left behind as things have gotten more complicated and more humanistic and whatever. But there's a time, and it was a good long run, where he was just nailing it every time. And so what you do is you have to do that. So like, and I think, I'm not trying to compare myself to John Carmack, but I think one of the things that's interesting about Spy Party is that it does do that. And The Sims does this too, where because they invert the design of not trying to make the AIs be perfectly human, it makes them implementable, but which makes them something you can actually work on iteratively and develop. And so it's trying to hit the behavioral version of trying to hit these knees of the curve where you can actually work on the problem and make progress. You're not trying to do human level, you know, strong AI, but the game design works with it, and you can get compelling results. And so what I'm urging you to do is work on highly leveraged and relevant problems right at the edge of your ability to solve them, and then really test the solutions. And by test the solutions, that's a euphemism for make a game that is interesting to play. I don't mean fun. I don't mean you can make a game that's not fun. I don't care about fun. I care about something that is compelling. Someone wants to sit down and play it, and they have an emotional reaction to it, an aesthetics goal. It doesn't have to be hard. If you look at Eco, the vast majority of Eco is a really generic puzzle platform game. It's not a very good game. But that moment when you call the princess and she comes and grabs your hand and you pull her along, that is magic that has not been reproduced since. And there's like 400 lines of code in that. Like, it's not a hard problem to find it. They're laying all over the floor when you start talking about intimate level things like this. An example from Spy Party, I got drinks in. There's going to be a poison the drink mission, right? And I didn't quite get it done for PAX. But I got the drink system in, so there's a waiter who offers you drinks, and everybody randomly starts with a drink with some percentage, whatever. And I was like, okay, well, that's at least there's drinks in the room. It's ambiently cool, like, whatever. You know, I'll take it to PAX with, like, that. I didn't get the mission. Oh, well, you know, you've got to cut at some point. But I'll leave the drinks in. And then it emerged that I tried to do the right thing, because I'm trying to do this high-touch, high-fidelity, like, personal experience. If you have a drink in your hand, you can't bug the ambassador on that side, right? Because you're holding a drink. If you have a drink in your hand, you can't pick up a book, right? You can't pick up the statues if you have a drink in your hand. So now, all of a sudden, 2.5 out of 4 missions are off-limits if you start with a drink. So now, all of a sudden, the spy has to, like, chug the drink at the beginning if they want to do their missions, right? And that's, boom, gameplay. Like, Now you don't want to look like you're chugging the drink because then you're going to get shot. So now you've got a drink and you're trying to play it cool. And of course, if you're like really playing the Yomi layers, you like halfway through, you try and front load the missions that don't require a drink. And then you take a drink because of course the spy won't have a drink. So why would, you know, anybody who's got a drink is less suspect. Things like that. This is like, I didn't design that. Like this just emerged from me just putting a bunch of people in a room and adding drinks to the mix. There's so much gameplay laying all over the floor with human behavior that it's insane that only The Sims and me, and to some extent like Heavy Rain, there's just very, very few games working on this stuff at all. And so it doesn't have to be some giant hard AI problem. I'm not saying you have to do a game the size of Final Fantasy when I say you have to do a game. There is a ton of stuff out there to do. And the reason I'm so mean to all of you is that I think that AI is the future of games, and so that you guys need to step up to the plate. Because the graphics people aren't going to get us there. Like, AI is where it's at. So, there you go. That's my talk.
It seemed like most of the problems that you pointed out as sort of real problems were really at the boundary of AI and animation. Are there AI problems that are gameplay problems that don't touch animation that people in the community could think about as well?
Well, I mean, obviously, yes, but from the game that I'm working on, and I actually think one of the places we fall down the most is humans in a room doing stuff. And it just the fact is a lot of that is visual. Visual is the wrong word because that makes it sound like I'm talking about skin shaders. But I mean, I'm looking at all of you, and you're all doing stuff and like looking, you're rifling your papers, and it's like that. The way that works is animation. It's like there is no difference between animation and AI at some level when you're talking about a human being interacting. So like, yes, you could work on some... I mean, well, so I'll invert the question. If you work on some cognitive process, I mean, so I'm saying basically work on people as a kind of implicit thing, just because I think that's the most interesting place. That's the reason movies are about people is because people like people, right? Yes, of course, you can do bots for some strategy game or whatever, and that's interesting, but it's like when Kasparov got beat by Big Blue or whatever, like, you know, when the chess barrier finally fell, like, it was kind of neat and got some news for a while, but no one really cared because, like chess, it's, like, not that big of a deal. Like, it's not a creative, you know, it's just, like, grounded out, you know? And so, like, humans and subtlety and, like, that kind of behavioristic stuff is where we should all be working, in my opinion. This is all, obviously, my opinion. But, so... You could work on cognitive process. So assume if you take that as a given, what are you going to work on that doesn't have any animation output? Like, how do you even express, how do you even display what's happening with the humans if you're not doing animation? So
yeah, I mean, one of the surprises me about some of the work in like this community is that we don't see more people saying, like, I'm targeting an interactive comic book, I'm targeting a textual experience.
Right.
Because I'm not worried about animation.
Right. Well, it's interesting that you're the one asking this, but like, I think text is way fucking harder than animation is, right? Because because generating and parsing text is hard AI. So like, give it up. Like this is, I mean, so it's way easier. I mean, you saw the animations in Spy Party. They're garbage. I did them myself, but they still get the point across in a completely dynamic way. And you can't do the text adventure version of Spy Party right now that is not just this canned, like, stilted parser fighting nightmare, right? Once, eventually, when we have really good parsers and really good text generation, do the text thing. But it is easier to do animation than it is to do text, in my opinion. Because you're the human... I mean, so the reason people didn't notice that the only time two people were talking in the same conversation circle was because one of them was a spy during the mission, is because there's so much stuff going on that you're just like willing to give it the benefit of the doubt. It's a party and a bunch of people at the party, right? So of course there's people talking all over the place. Why wouldn't there be? There weren't. But you don't get that benefit of a doubt when it's dynamically generated text. Like, it's just a way, way harder problem. I love text adventures, but they're just like, it's a much harder problem in my opinion. So. Take the easy way out. Have some dudes on the screen smile at you. Like, you just get, like, it's so much implied by that. Like, you don't have to be Hemingway. You had your hand up. Yeah.
Yeah, so, going back to what you said about the outro.
And
how you don't think the sequel is quality.
Right. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, like, clearly there's got to be procedural glue. This actually gets to the, like, I mean, not to bait Michael, but like, this gets to the Photoshop of AI thing, which is where you've got this, like, what is the blending operator for behavior? You know, I don't know, because blends are really how you save your ass on the combinatorial explosion, right? You just pray that, like, it's going to lerp to the right thing. And I don't know what the right thing is. Is it an asset of transition? Is it better proceduralism that's like kind of involves the artist at more levels? I don't know. I don't know. I mean, that's why it's an open problem. If I had the solution, I wouldn't put it on the open problem slide. Yeah, in the back.
Chris, do you think that they think in the long term the solution to the AI animation intersection problem is completing detailed physical simulation? And by that, I want to include not just realistic, but even be cartoon physics, but the long way that completely controls everything.
Well, I used to think so, but the problem is that, and it's not that I don't agree with that, it's the problem is like this. So if you follow physics and chemistry and whatnot, like, obviously the solution, you know, so like there's that hierarchy of like, you know, math, physics, chemistry, biology, sociology, you know, psychology, sociology, anthropology, right? You know, in terms of like lack of rigor, some people would say, or whatever, or less simulatability, maybe, or whatever thing you want it. So, yes, but so obviously the solution to all chemistry problems is to just simulate it, right? Except for right now, like I think you can simulate a hydrogen atom for like 4 picoseconds. So yes, it is physical simulation, but the amount of physics going on with me taking, you know, talking to you and doing all this stuff is just way beyond our reach right now. So, and where I switched from doing physics stuff, when I switched from physics to doing more like behavioral hacky state machine based human level AI, When I switched, it's because I realized that like rigid body mechanics is beautiful reductionist math, but it's not going to get us where we need to be fast enough. Eventually, everything will be soft body simulated, blah, blah, blah. But it's not actually the hard part, right? That's just like, got to wait for computers to catch up. Like, we know all that math. And that whole, your mind is just willing to forgive the like pop. And those animations in there were popping all over the place, but the person playing the game wasn't caring. And I want to get rid of those pops because I think that you do actually care in a way you can't actually express. It matters, but it doesn't matter to the point where you need to back it all the way up to simulating for a picosecond to try and get the hydrogen atom going. We gotta jump ahead farther and like go like, look, we did trials and this medicine is efficacious in this situation. We don't know why, it's bonding some shit to something in your brain, gotta go with it, right? We don't have a simulation of it. This is where fMRI is like this fantasy of psychologists, like a certain kind of behaviorist psychologist thinks that fMRI will just solve all problems. You just strap person in an fMRI machine and like, you just like, you know, stimulate them like they see a banana and here's what happened. And boom, we'll just know what happened. That's not going to happen any more than it happened with physics and chemistry. Like, it's just too complicated. So.
Last one.
Yep.
So, I mean, one of the big and controversial points we made was that what we, you know, we're not focusing enough on making interesting games, and maybe that's why a lot of times industry doesn't take research seriously or whatnot.
Well, I think it's the reason, it's not, I mean, now I'm going to really stick my foot in it, but I think it's the reason the research isn't that good.
Okay?
It's not that the research is awesome and we're ignoring it. It's just not that good. Because, and I'm saying it's causal, it's because it's not, this, there's no aesthetics to it. It's not based in anything that matters for games. So does that...
Well, so, and I, maybe, can you clarify that with an example? Like, maybe, I...
Now, I'm not going to call out someone's paper and go like, this is crap. No.
I hate to ask you to pick on someone specific, so...
Okay, here's an example. Yes, I will give you an example, Edris. This way, I will not pick out a single person, but I think, how many people here participated in the StarCraft bot thing? No one in the room? Oh, two. All right, so you guys are going to get offended. Ready? Why do StarCraft bots? Because it's a solvable problem, right? Why not write, I was thinking about that. This is not fully formed. I cut this out of the slides because I wasn't actually sure, but I'm going to like, here we go. Like, StarCraft bots are a fun problem the same way a chess bot is a fun problem, right? Like, grind it out, like, you know, you got the inputs, and it's more creative, than it's got more variables and maybe a higher branch vector, maybe. But why not do Sims bots? And the reason is, for the same reason that, like, Spy Party doesn't need human-level AI, the Sims is robust in the face of shitty AI, right? The game doesn't need you to do a good bot, because the game is more subtle and happening at more, at different cognitive levels than a micro twitchy StarCraft bot, right? And or even a macro twitchy StarCraft bot. And so in some sense, the games that are working at the human level don't actually need AI researchers because we've already like routed around the damage, so to speak. Like Spy Party, as I improve the AI, the game will get better, but it doesn't need, the game will get different, but it doesn't need good AI. prima facie, like, you can play it right now, and it's an interesting game, right? Knock on wood. Hopefully it will stay that way as I improve it. But, like, and The Sims is, too. The Sims is crappy AI. Like, it's not like, you're not ever confused that that's a real person. It's like the game is based around the broken AI in the same way that Spy Party is based around the human pretending to be the broken AI, not the opposite. And so, in some sense, like, I think part of the reason is that this stuff doesn't get worked on is because it's hard to come up with game designs in this area, right? But also the things you might mod, the things that are easy to mod and whatever, are not the things that, like, I mean, they're the things that are easy to do. I mean, I'm kind of fumbling here at the thing, but maybe I've gotten the idea across. It's like, work on Sims bots, even though they don't need you, to try and find out what the new, interesting, different game is there. The Sims is a wide open thing that, like, The Sims is trying to be all TV shows about people, and so it's none of them, right? So, like, what's the, so here, a common example I use in a thing that's missing from The Sims is, I'll get you next, you don't have to, like, your arm doesn't have to fall off. What's the difference between Seinfeld and Friends? In Sims space, there is no difference between Seinfeld and Friends. But in, you're watching the TV show, they're completely different TV shows. Why? There's three people in a room in New York, like, it's exactly the same show, right? But it's not. What's the difference there? Interactivity cannot reach that difference yet. There's something to work on. You know what I mean? All right, I'm back.
The reason we have a conversation with StarCraft, which is participating in it,
yeah.
And not on SimSpot,
yeah.
Is that it's very hard to evaluate what it
is. Yes, so totally, that's what I'm talking about, yeah.
But if it would be a great competition, maybe we should check one up.
Well, I don't know what the competition would be, but yeah, it would be interesting.
No, I think competition would be good, but we need a proper way of spending.
Yeah, well, I mean, there doesn't have to be a winner, though, right? Huh? Who wins, Seinfeld or Friends? Like, it's not, there doesn't have to be a winner, because it doesn't have to be, I don't know, like, aesthetics is qualitative, is part of the thing. What's that? The one with the most viewers? Well, maybe. I mean, a lot of people like Arrested Development, and they think it's a better show than both of those. So who knows? In the realm of aesthetics, it's hard to say, yes, that's the problem, and that's what I'm trying to get at is the aesthetics thing. Are we done? I guess we're over. All right, thanks a lot.